Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now for his first appearance since taking office, Mayor Bill de Blasio. Mr. Mayor, belated congratulations on your inauguration and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's good to be back.
First things first, did you really drop the groundhog yesterday?
That is a feisty groundhog there. Let me tell you, quite an active animal.
Bit Mayor Bloomberg.
Yes, I did. He didn't bite me, at least. I had him for a while, and then he squirmed out. We got him back, but all I can say is I know how Peyton Manning feels at this point.
Ooh. Want to give us your own big picture take on your first month? I think everyone sees you pushing on the exact fronts you campaigned on: universal pre-K, paid sick leave, stop and frisk. What's the first month headline or lead paragraph if you were writing it yourself?
I think there's a lot of momentum for our agenda. I think the fact is that we have very consistently gone at the issues we think define the inequality crisis in New York City and attack them head on. I could not be happier with the work we're doing together with the City Council on the paid sick leave bill. That's going to add 500,000 people covered by April, and we've had tremendous partnership with Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito on that. We are making a lot of progress on pre-K and after school, and obviously have helped to put that issue in the fore of the public debate. And on stop and frisk, the settlement we reached is truly historic. We've ended years and years, in fact, in some ways, decades of litigation around these issues, and working together with the advocates at the police department, the corporation council, we're actually moving towards the kind of reform we've envisioned for a long time, and we should be having real progress on that in the coming days.
When you get universal pre-K, and it looks like you're going to get it one way or another, those tens of thousands of kids will have to sit somewhere. And I saw the reports of the budget from Friday afternoon that you'll it looks like you'll redirect $200 million of capital funding from charter school construction to pre-K construction. Can you fill us in on what exactly that is?
No, that's not accurate. You know, some of the media accounts were accurate and some were leading and drew their own conclusions inappropriately. We've simply said that we're not spending the $200 million-plus on charter expansion. We have not determined the best use of that money. It will align to our overall agenda. The agenda includes addressing overcrowding in places like Central Queens and in the North Shore of Staten Island and in Tribeca and parts of the East and West Side where there's been wait lists. So one issue is school overcrowding in general. Another issue is pre-K. We have a lot of capital needs. We thought the money would be better used on those needs than on further charter expansion. But the separate point to your core of your question, we do expect to get going with pre-K for September. The white paper that we published last Monday delineates exactly how we are going to find the space right now from existing sources right now, schools that have additional classrooms, community organizations that have done pre-K and childcare that have additional classrooms. We have the teaching core. We have the curriculum in place. So we're going to, by our projection, have full-day pre-K available for 54,000 kids. That's a gain of 34,000 full-day seats if Albany will do the right thing and allow the city of New York to make its own decisions about its own revenue.
There are dozens of schools, charters, and district schools that are supposed to open this coming fall, and from our education department's reporting, they now don't know their destiny. Do you think any of the charter co-locations that were approved last year before Bloomberg left office should be actually canceled?
Well, I think the process was very bad, as usual. I think the entire Bloomberg administration process on co-locations and closures was a broken one that didn't consult with parents and communities effectively. We're reviewing them. We're going to look at what we think of the overall situation and the individual schools involved, and then we'll come back with some answers. So I can safely say this was a horrible process. We're going to be instituting a moratorium from this point forward. But we don't have the answers yet on what we think is viable for the school year starting in September based on these previous actions by the Bloomberg administration.
One more thing on this. There are two lawsuits to stop co-locations that were filed against the Bloomberg administration, as you know, one that public advocate Tish James is a plaintiff in, the other from the UFT. Do you plan to settle or not contest those, like you reversed Bloomberg and settled the stop and frisk suit?
We're going to look at that, too. There's a lot of, as you can imagine, Brian, there's many lawsuits from the previous regime that have to be looked at. So it's a case-by-case situation. We clearly know this, and I've said it very consistently. I think people have seen with this first month we are very focused and consistent in our agenda. So there will be a moratorium on closures and co-locations, and the idea is to create a much better system of consultation with parents and communities before we decide how to proceed thereafter. How that interacts with the lawsuits, I'm not sure. But, you know, we want to show people a very different approach. And I bluntly said that parents are stakeholders in this school system. They've never been treated that way by the previous administration, and we have to change that. Parents have a right to have a serious say in things affecting their own kids.
My guest is Mayor de Blasio here on WNYC. And the change of politics is so clear from Bloomberg and Quinn to you and Melissa Mark-Viverito. That's why you and council were able to agree instantly on a paid sick leave expansion that was bottled up for the last 3 years. With this much unity of vision, what's your second act? What's your third act with inequality fighting legislation that needs both you and the council? Anything you can get specific on?
Well, we're going to be saying a lot more in the State of the City speech next Monday. And the point is that we want to follow through consistently on the agenda laid out over the last year. Clearly, one of the big issues here is addressing both job creation and quality job creation, so improving wages and benefits. Paid sick leave is a part of that. Living wage is a part of that. There'll be a lot of pieces that I delineate based on that notion. You know, the bottom line is fighting inequality. It happens on many, many fronts. I think the great news is the city council wants to be shoulder to shoulder with us in this. So I think you're going to see a lot of emphasis on the issue of how to get more New Yorkers back to work and at levels of wages and benefits that are actually sufficient for a family.
I read that you and council along those lines might next expand the living wage law in a way that Bloomberg and Quinn opposed. Is that correct?
Well, I've said that over the last year. That's one of my aspirations, is to really greatly expand living wage law. This is based on companies we subsidize, companies that get public subsidy that I think should be held to a higher standard. I give President Obama a lot of credit for pushing the spectrum on where we need to go on wages and benefits. Obviously, I give him credit for working on the number one benefit that everyone relies on, which is health insurance. We have to deepen our efforts locally, and if we're subsidizing companies, we have every right to demand of them a living wage for the people they pay.
And this really goes, I think, in a big picture way to one of the core values that you're trying to govern on. And tell me if you would put it this way, that there should be a basic social contract in this country. No American should work full time and still be in poverty. Paid sick leave and living wage are obviously about that. Are you trying to strive toward that as a basic premise at city level?
Exactly right. Look, I'll put a point on it. We have even some city workers, some of our lowest paid city workers who are living in shelter because they can't afford all the life expenses, rent, and et cetera, for their family. That's unacceptable. So the notion here, and I think you're right, this is a New York City phenomenon, but it's a nationwide phenomenon as well. We have to reconstruct the kind of middle class we used to have. It will require very substantial government investments and actions. It won't happen by letting the free market go unfettered. It won't happen with trickle-down economics. It will only happen with a very systematic strategy to restore the middle class. And what we're doing here with living wage, with paid sick leave, with efforts to create the kind of job training will get people at more higher quality jobs, higher paying jobs, you know, supporting other efforts like the fast food workers and their efforts to get decent wages and benefits. All of these, supporting the airport workers, all of this is of a piece locally to try and do what I wish was being done nationally in a coherent way, which is to restore the middle class.
How about the airport workers? I think one of the things they want is for the city to take jurisdiction of the minimum wage there. I think Port Authority is somehow separate, correct me if I'm wrong, and those private contractors who contract with the Port Authority and then pay such low wages to their workers are exempt from city law. Is that correct?
Well, Port Authority is separate, and Port Authority governs over the airports. I don't know the fine points of the legal dynamics. I do know that the Port Authority could do a lot more to use its power to prevail upon the employers at the airports to provide decent wages and benefits. I'm pleased by some of the, you know, the words we've heard the last few days from the Port Authority. I think there's some progress. But I don't know enough whether we have the legal capacity to intervene. I'm certainly going to use every other capacity I have to intervene.
You know, it would be nice if politicians in all the localities in the area shared your commitment to not living in poverty if you have a job. But since they don't, are you afraid of having other places poach jobs from New York City with their lower standards as you pursue this agenda?
No. I think the fact is that New York City has a lot of strengths, obviously. Our economy is much better diversified than it was 10 or 20 years ago, and I do give Mayor Bloomberg credit for some of the policies that helped that along in terms of real estate values. You know, we're in a very strong position. People want to be here, let's face it. People want to be here from all over the world. So we have a strong hand to play, and I think given just the power of our market, given just the spending power of this city, a lot of companies need to be here and want to be here. So I think we have a very strong foundation to push things like living wage and these better benefits. In fact, I look at the wealth levels in this city, and this gets back to why I think it's right to tax the wealthiest New Yorkers for full-day pre-K and for after school. The wealth levels in the city are astounding. The income inequality in the city is the greatest it's been since the Great Depression, since 1929, and it's growing all the time. We have to take corrective actions to have a strong and stable city for the future. We have the platform to do it. I think if we don't do it, if places like New York don't do it, it won't happen in a lot of other places. So I would argue, in effect, the other way around. We have to set a new standard. It gets back to your earlier question about fighting poverty. We have to set a new standard of what's expected and then challenge other jurisdictions to meet it.
I'm sure you oppose the food stamps cuts coming from Washington. But I also know that food stamp applicants here sometimes feel that HRA has unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles to getting SNAP benefits. Is this something that you heard much about, maybe as public advocate or perceived to be a problem?
Well, yeah, I do absolutely oppose the cuts in Washington. I think they were very they were mean-spirited, actually. They were really undercutting hardworking folks, and folks have very limited resources and needed food aid, including for children. I think it's unbelievable that they were subject to the cuts that they were. And it's something we'll keep fighting in our federal agenda. But, yeah, look, for years and years, until recently, there was widespread fingerprinting as part of the policy of how folks, working people, got food stamps. That's unacceptable, and it's something we're going to work on across the board to destigmatize and take away some of the punitive elements of our approach to helping people in need. You know, that being said, I'm also someone who thinks that there are areas where we have to be tight and careful about what happens with some of the benefit dollars. You know, I'm someone who believes that they shouldn't have been used, for example, for sugary drinks. It's something I agreed with the Bloomberg administration on. I think the governor's right to say that there should be some limitations in terms of types of public assistance being used in inappropriate locations. So I think the balance here is that we destigmatize, we offer an open hand to people in need, but we also put some common sense limitations on.
There have been a few bumps along the way for you this month. One was the AIPAC speech. You acknowledged it was a misstep to try to do that for the pro-Israel lobby group secretly, which they had asked for.
Well, it's not secret. I'm just going to stop you. It was a closed press event, as are many. What we acknowledge very clearly is the media has every, and the public has every right to know when I'm giving a speech. And but for certain exceptional situations, we will publish the text of any such speech.
On the content of your speech there, given your general politics, I might not have figured you for such an ambiguous supporter of Israel, as opposed to someone who'd speak more about a balance between Israeli security and Palestinian conditions and self-determination.
I think you said ambiguous. I assume you meant unambiguous.
Unambiguous. Forgive me. Do you have a bigger picture position than that speech might have reflected?
Well, of course, it's a very complicated dynamic in the Middle East. I think the core of this is I am unabashedly pro-Israel, meaning the state of Israel, the survival of Israel, the sense of alliance that this country needs to have with Israel. I think Israel is in constant danger. I think, bluntly, there's been some real indications of sustained anti-Semitism all over the world. That doesn't mean I agree with every policy of the Israeli government at any given moment, of course. So, and by the way, and an example where I strongly agree with the current administration in Washington, where I agree with President Obama, is on sanctions. I think the deal that has been struck with Iran is an incredible first step. I think it has to be watched very, very carefully. I think if there's backsliding by Iran, there have to be very serious steps taken to address it. So I'll obviously have my differences with any given organization or any given foreign government. But my core point here is I, as the mayor of the city that has this extraordinary deep tie to Israel and the huge Jewish population we have, I do think it's incumbent upon me to defend the state of Israel in the context of a very hostile world.
I want to come back to the core issue of inequality. We're in a national, even global moment, I think, on inequality as a focus. You're leading on it. I think you've helped to change the national conversation, but also President Obama talking more explicitly in these terms, and the new Pope internationally. Have you ever had a conversation with Pope Francis?
I am looking forward to it one day. I've got together with the Cardinal, and we're trying to encourage Pope Francis to visit New York City at some point, and I would be tremendously honored to meet him. I think what he's saying has changed the global discussion. I think he has reframed the discussion of inequality in very sharp and compelling terms. So I'd be honored to meet him, but I'll tell you right now, the whole national and local debate has been positively affected by the clarion call of this pope.
Mayor de Blasio with us for just another couple of minutes. And let's finish up with a quick lightning round. They don't have to be yes or no answers. I'll call it a soft core lightning round, but short
takes. That's a new media phrase, soft core lightning round.
Soft core, I'm inventing that right now.
You can patent it.
There's a group that's been writing into us about some branch libraries doing real estate deals with developers that would give them renovation funding, the libraries, but also shrink their space. Do you support the library leadership in those deals?
I have been critical of the initial plans. I don't know if there's updated ones I haven't seen, but the initial plans around the Central Library in Manhattan and around some of the branches in Brooklyn that I thought did not protect community interests. That being said, I'm always going to look for financially viable long-term plans. I mean, we are in a tough fiscal situation going forward. As you know, 150 open labor contracts that will have a real cost impact going forward, a real fiscal impact. So I don't take lightly that we have to find a way to pay for things, but I did not like the original plans I saw for those libraries.
Okay. Lapel pin cameras for some police officers. Are you for it or against
yes,
it as part of the final settlement?
In favor. It's part of the settlement we agreed to.
Is a crackdown on jaywalking part of Vision Zero?
No. The fact is we respect that local precinct commanders may, in particular situations, as was true on the Upper West Side recently, determine that special actions need to be taken on jaywalking if there's a real problem point. It's not part of the larger vision of how we approach Vision Zero.
Will you make Lunar New Year, the two Muslim Eids, and Diwali school holidays?
Haven't spoken about Diwali yet on the other two. The goal is to get there. I've said repeatedly it will take time. It is complicated in terms of logistics and school calendar and budget, but it's something I want to get done in a reasonable time frame.
Our music department wants to know, do you have a cultural affairs commissioner in mind yet, or what are you looking for in one?
Soon coming. We have not made that announcement. It's something we'll do in the coming weeks. A lot of people excited and seeking that role. It's been one of the ones where we've gotten some great, great talent coming forward.
When did you and Dante give up on the Super Bowl last night?
I think on the kickoff that began the third quarter that it was quite evident that that game was irretrievable for the Broncos. And I was supporting Seattle, so I can't say I feel bad about that. But as a game, at that point, it became hard to focus on as much.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman, is there anything you want to say about his life or the way he apparently died?
Quintessential New Yorker in the sense of, you know, just everything we love about this place, his creativity and his amazing ability to portray the human condition, and it's absolutely tragic. And I think, look, what I can say about his life is even someone of that extraordinary achievement grapples with the demon of substance abuse, and we have to keep surfacing this reality in our society and getting people help. It's out there. Help is out there. There's extraordinary organizations that help people, Alcoholics Anonymous and many others, and we've got to keep surfacing it as a public discussion, and also anyone in our lives, we have to keep pushing them towards these positive outcomes and solutions.
So finally, any quick preview of the de Blasio administration month two, or anything else you'd like to say to our listeners to finish up?
Well, we're going to take this fight against inequality through a series of different issues. It runs through everything we talk about, whether it's reforming stop and frisk, whether it's addressing wages and benefits, and obviously getting kids pre-K and after school who aren't getting it now. This is all about creating a more just society. There's a lot more ahead on living wage and many other issues. And it's going to be a relentless effort to achieve this agenda. What I can say to your listeners is the amount of support for this agenda is astounding. We've seen it time and time again. On the pre-K, by the way, not only did we see it in the public opinion polls in New York City, the polls in the suburbs and upstate showed just as much vigor for the plan. So I think it's a moment in history where people want inequality addressed, and we're going to do that relentlessly.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for coming on today, and I look forward to talking to you regularly, I hope, during your administration.
Looking forward to it, Brian. Take care, man.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now your calls. Folks, how is Mayor de Blasio doing? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. React to anything he said in that interview and his first month on the job, 212-433-9692. How's Mayor de Blasio doing in general or on any specific policy that you like, don't like, or ambivalent about? Your calls on de Blasio at the 1 month point, 212-433-WNYC, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. We'll take your de Blasio calls right after this. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. Coming up shortly, the latest in our series, Context and a Movie. Today, the real-life scandal behind American Hustle. And since Slate film critic Dana Stevens will be here for that, we'll also use the opportunity to talk more about Philip Seymour Hoffman. But first, let's take some of your calls on how you think Mayor de Blasio is doing after 1 month in office. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Susan in Jackson Heights here on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was calling in to say in Jackson Heights this morning, the plows have been coming through all morning, doing a very good job.
So an A on snow removal in Jackson Heights.
I'm so happy that he got in, and I like, you know, his agenda, and I like his stance on things. So I just wish him well.
Thank you very much. Emma in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on the mayor's comments about Israel, specifically his unequivocal support for Israel, and just remind him that for all the excitement and the freshness that he brought to his constituent space, I'm an Arab American, and I'm part of that constituency also. And for the tale of two cities that he is, you know, going around and talking about, we also are part of his constituency that he should remember. There is also that tale of two demographic groups, and he has alienated the Arab American community in his unequivocal support for Israel and just disregarding the other side. There's two stories here. I also support Israel, but that doesn't mean that that's it. There's other sides to the story.
And you didn't find the way he tried to balance that in his answer just before to be sufficient to you?
Did you? I didn't hear balance. I didn't hear any balance. I heard unequivocal, unambiguous, my role as mayor is to support them. I didn't hear any balance. I didn't hear any mention even of any other side.
Emma, thank you very much. Trudy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I remember when Bill de Blasio got arrested for supporting Long Island College Hospital. As a matter of fact, he held my hand when I was about to get arrested for supporting the hospital. And now that we're happy to say he's mayor, we'd like to know, I really need to know, what he is going to do to keep that a full-service hospital.
And I know they're working on that, and they're trying to get with Governor Cuomo some federal money so that it could be financially sustainable. And he acknowledges some restructuring of some kind is going to be necessary because it can't just be losing money and losing money. But, it didn't come up in our conversation. I didn't choose to bring it up in our conversation right now. I think he's been talking about it a lot, and that his answer to you would be something like that he's looking for a kind of more regional approach so that even if that hospital on its own had some problems, it was part of a larger system that could still support the need for that hospital that exists in the community. So obviously he's with his commitment to that and interfaith, going to do more on that coming down the pike. We did talk to public advocate Tish James about that on Friday. If you want to go back and listen to that interview, I think they say about the same thing on that. Andrea in Red Hook, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I missed most of your interview with Mayor de Blasio. Did you guys cover Sandy recovery at all?
No.
Okay. Well, a big exclamation point, question mark, why not? There's just still so many people really barely recovering. The Build It Back program is not meeting people's needs. And there's something called an action plan that's going to be put into effect. There's a comment period. Everyone can chime in. If you go to nyc.gov, find the action plan, comment on Build It Back, comment on your unmet needs.
Right. And as to why we didn't talk about it, there were so many topics that we didn't talk about in, a short interview, and we have to make decisions in each one, and maybe not this time and maybe next time. But do you feel that the de Blasio administration is not being responsive or is being responsive? Has anything changed as far as you're concerned since the since the Bloomberg administration, for better or for worse, or what's your particular concern here, or what do you need that you think they may not be hearing, because they're certainly listening to this segment?
Sure. Well, it's early days yet, so this is a complex situation. The Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability is an incredible team, and I hope they remain on. I trust that they will. A lot of issues that need to be dealt with, and we just need more attention for those that are not getting their needs met. Their houses are gone, or they're gutted, and people are unaware of this. This is a very continuing story.
Andrea, thank you very much, and good luck. Danny in Rockaway Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Danny.
Yes, good morning, Brian. How are you and
okay. Everybody
there?
Good.
We want to really thank him. I got to give him a plus. He extended the Rockaway Ferry, and we're very excited about that. And we're hoping to have a thank you press conference here in Rockaway in the near future, and I hope he takes our invitation. Very happy about it.
Thank you very much. Henry in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Brian. As to the mayor and how things are going, I wish him well. I suspect he'll have some difficulties down the road because you can't squeeze blood from a stone, and eventually somebody's going to have to pay for these proposals, and I suspect there'll be a pushback. I certainly hope so. But I really was curious to hear from you what your take is on sort of the overarching analysis of the mayors and others income inequality, it has a sense to it that it's someone's fault. In other words, those people whose incomes are deemed inadequate are in their place and in the difficult spot they're in because someone else has done well. There is that that tone, that scent to it of blame, of fault. And I wonder if I can get your thoughts on that.
Well, my impression is that there isn't very much of that, that there is sometimes in some rhetoric, oh, those bankers or whatever. But even that is often very specific about, you know, policies and practices within certain corporations or regulation that allows things to go on. And I think, for example, in the interview that we just had, what you heard from Mayor de Blasio was not any particular blaming of the rich, but going through specific things that he wants to bring up the bottom with respect to the social contract we were discussing, that people who work full-time for a living shouldn't wind up below the poverty line, and so dealing with living wage and paid sick and things like that. He's going to run into difficulty, as any mayor would, with raising the large middle or raising a lot of people to an expanded middle that he hopes to create, because it's always hard to attract the right kinds of higher-paying middle-class jobs and not just make things a little better for the people at the bottom. I think that's going to be the thing that he hasn't really started to address yet. That's going to be very different for him, difficult for him, as it would for any mayor. And you say you can't get blood from a stone. Well, he would say, who's the stone that the only tax hike that he's proposing is a few thousand dollars more on people making $500,000 or more? So, that's my analysis, is that it really has to do with expanding the shrinking middle class, not just on Mayor de Blasio's part. And look at the Times today. The Times has a really revealing and troubling story about high-end retailers in this country doing really, really well, and the regular retailers, like they use Red Lobster as an example, where business is down, whereas Capital Grille and other higher-end eateries, business is up, as a reflection of the fact that there's a shrinking middle class in this country, while those who are well off are doing very, very well and consistently so, which is not to blame them, but which is to say there's a serious problem that needs to be addressed.
Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Let me sort of give you a little bit of informed gossip.
Okay, do it in about a minute, okay?
All right, sure. I had lunch before the election with a couple of substantial citizens, people who employ a lot of people in the city and who make things happen. And they were nervous. They were upset because they drew, according to them, a straight line from the mayor's agenda and background and intentions, and saw bad things happening. And I think too little attention is being paid, frankly, by the media, and which includes you, and sensible people in general, to the notion that nothing is cost-free, that responsibility is required as much as is a just and fair social policy.
Right. And, Henry, I'm going to leave it there, but I think that's one of the challenges for the de Blasio administration. Time will tell whether these new requirements for business, for their lower-end employees, whether whatever tax hike, if any, gets approved on the wealthiest 1%, the $500,000 plus, whether that makes businesses flee or any other thing. And obviously, he's willing to gamble that he can improve the lives of people without chasing out people who will feel excluded or will feel that their money is better made somewhere else to the detriment of everybody. And there you go. Henry, thank you for your call. Keep calling us. And everybody, thanks for your calls telling us how you think Mayor de Blasio is doing. You can keep posting to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, Amy Chua, already known as the Tiger Mom, with her husband, Jed Rubenfeld, and their controversial new book, The Triple Package. They attempt to explain the rise and fall of different cultural groups in America. The pushback has been fierce. We will hear from the Tiger Mom and her husband later in the program. Also today, New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer, in his first headline act, sends back a contract to provide 311 service, a Bloomberg no-bid contract, to the same company that botched the Obamacare rollout. Scott Stringer will join us. Plus, the New York Academy of Medicine's first Age Smart Workplace Awards, why a health research and advocacy group is taking on workplace aging. And we're compiling two lists about the Sochi Olympics, which, of course, are about to begin. We'll compare our doesn't inspire confidence list and our maybe it'll be okay list. But first, we begin today in the wake of the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman's death from a heroin overdose with a conversation about addiction and support. There's news this morning of the arrest of four people who may have sold him the drugs. But as the tabloids focus on the grisly details, many more of you out there we know are relating to this one fact. Hoffman was someone who had struggled with heroin addiction at the age of 22, apparently overcome it, quit drugs and alcohol, and then he relapsed 23 years later. So for those who've struggled with addiction or seen a loved one do so, this is a reminder, as if you needed one, that you never truly cure something like heroin addiction. And so we open up the phones right now, not looking for answers necessarily, but to discuss this complicated issue. We have a great guest who'll join us in just a minute, but we want to hear from you. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you're someone who has struggled with addiction or someone who has tried to support someone with a drug or alcohol problem, give us a call. What did you think when you heard about Hoffman's death and relapse? What lessons might you have for others out there who might need to know how to help someone they love who is struggling? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And since we know the science around addiction and treatment is so murky and contentious, here to help take your calls is Carrie Wilkins, Clinical Director of the Center for Motivation and Change and the co-author of a brand new book called Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. Carrie, welcome to WNYC. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
So can we start with the name of your book, How Science and Kindness Help People Change? The word change is itself fraught, because I know a lot of people who think you can't actually change someone. You can only manage. What do you mean by change?
Well, there's lots of words in that title that I'm quite fond of, because we chose to put science in the title because there is so much we now know about addiction, how the change process works, how motivation works, how you can impact all of those things in a very positive way. So we filled the book with all of that information and also what science has taught us about how substances affect the brain and the body, because we really feel that family members should be armed with this information so they can be better educated consumers. What is surprising, I think, to a lot of people is that the science actually suggests kindness is one of the most important things when you're working with somebody with a substance problem.
And that's probably the most surprising word
right.
in the title.
Yeah.
Help people change through science and kindness, yeah. not through science and tough love
exactly.
or 12-step programs.
Well, I mean, the 12-step programs for many people are unbelievably kind and loving. The problem is that family members get this peculiar mixed message where they're told they essentially can't do anything, just like you started out, like you can't make somebody change, right? That is true. You can't make somebody change, but you can absolutely become a very effective change agent in somebody's life, and you can construct their environment, you can construct your communications. There's lots of very strategic things you can do that can have a very positive impact. And we wanted to help families because families desperately want to help. They don't want to distance themselves. They don't want to detach. That's a confusing message to a family member.
So let's go right to a caller from a family member, Natalie in Montclair. You're on WNYC. Natalie, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My brother died of a heroin overdose almost 2 years ago now, and I guess what I want to say about it is I didn't know that he was doing heroin, but I did know that he was addicted to cocaine because he told me, and I didn't do anything. And I guess what I learned is that
if you know someone has a problem. I also thought about the fact that I didn't think I could do anything, and he was still going to school and, you know, being a productive member of society, so it didn't seem so bad, but I didn't do anything. And just that if you know you're someone you love has a problem, you just, you know, do something.
Natalie, what in retrospect do you wish you had done?
I wish that I went to him and told him that he had a problem and that he needed help. Even if that maybe that wouldn't have done anything, it would have been something. And that, like, after, now that he's gone, I could have, you know, at least had that, known that I've done everything I could.
So, Natalie, stay there a minute. Carrie, is that where kindness begins?
Absolutely.
Telling somebody that they have a problem if you see that they have a problem?
Absolutely. And, Natalie, I'm very sorry that you had to suffer and you're now living with all of those very complicated feelings. But your message is super important for people to hear, which is, and I hear this from my clients all the time, they are so appreciative that when someone in their life says, hey, I'm worried about you, I'm noticing changes. You know, granted, some of them are very defensive and, you know, push it away and say, no, everything's fine. And you have to kind of deal with that as well. But one of the things that we talk about in Beyond Addiction are very specific communication strategies that families can learn to really have those conversations go well, you know, because you can really set somebody up to have a conversation where they're curious and feel like, oh, this person really cares about me. You can also set up a conversation that ends in conflict and, you know, more problems. And there are specific strategies that family members can practice and learn and feel better about their interactions with their loved ones.
How about Natalie's perception that it wasn't so bad because he was a functioning member of society? We think of addicts as, you know, lying in an alley somewhere as a stereotype. But if they're getting by, if they're cocaine users who are holding down their Wall Street jobs, you know, whatever it is, then, well, okay.
Yeah. No, I'm thankful that I think that is changing in the culture a little bit. There is absolutely more awareness. And Mr. Hoffman was somebody who did it very graciously. You know, he talked about his recovery and he was really successful and said how much he'd changed. His death absolutely reflects the vulnerability in the problem. And I think the more people can kind of be aware that this problem affects everybody. Really talented people, really smart people, really wealthy people, really poor people. Everybody's affected by this problem.
Natalie, anything else you want to say? You don't have
not
to.
Not that I can think of.
Okay.
Thank you, Natalie.
Never be silent.
Thank you very much. And I think you helped some other people out there with what you told us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On reaching out, you have a chapter on treatment and a little list called Exercise Preparing to Suggest Treatment. It's sort of a checklist for family members, maybe like Natalie, about when they should have a conversation with a loved one. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that you ask is there anyone in a better position than you to suggest treatment? Mm-hmm. Why do you include that? Are there times when you shouldn't be the one to reach out, even if it's your spouse or your brother or someone so close?
Yeah, sometimes it's just too hot. You know, I mean, sometimes there's just too much conflict. You've been at it too long. You're too burned out. And you know the conversation's not going to go well. So to really figure out, like, okay, is there a friend? Is there a colleague? Is there a sibling? You know, somebody else who could say, you know, again, start this conversation of, you know, we've looked into some options. I've really thought a lot about what would be a good place for you. And we've done some research. And here are some options. The big thing there being options. Because if you just say, I think you need to go to rehab, that's the only way out here. The conversation again ends saying, you know what, there's three people I've identified. Why don't you pick one? It can really help people say yes to.
And we do have a clip of Philip Seymour Hoffman that I want to play discussing his addiction on 60 Minutes. Here he talks about his struggles and the role that his professional career played in that addiction.
You panicked. It was I was 22, and I got panicked for my life. It really was. It was just that. And I always think, God, you know, I have so much empathy for these young actors that are 19, and all of a sudden they're beautiful and famous and rich. I'm like, oh, my God, I'd be dead. You know what I mean? I mean, 19, beautiful, famous, and rich, that'd be it. You know, I think back at that time, I think if I had the money, that kind of money and stuff.
Philip Seymour Hoffman on 60 Minutes in 2006, And Carrie, I wonder what it says about the relationship between the other parts of one's life and one's addiction. I don't really know anything about his personal life, but clearly this is someone who is successful and seemingly fulfilled by his professional life. So is success in your job not a powerful enough force to help mitigate addiction problems, irrelevant to addiction problems, a cause of addiction problems?
How about all of the above? The type of treatment that we talk about is something called community reinforcement approach. And for families, it includes family training in that. And the whole model is to build up your community to compete with your substance use. You know, if your relationships are good, if you're fulfilled by work, those all can really compete with the decision to use substances. You know, the problem is it can also be the opposite, which is your work is really stressful. Maybe you've had some stability in your substance use and a perfect storm of events, marital conflict, work stress, a depressive episode come together, and all of a sudden, substances become an option again. You really have to stay vigilant with this.
Carrie Wilkins with us, clinical director of the Center for Motivation and Change and co-author of Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Can Help People Change. And Julia in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Julia, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you for having me, and thank you so much to your guest. I just can't endorse what she's saying anymore. I'm experiencing recovery on behalf of my little sister. My entire family is in recovery. Mm-hmm. And this was not something we ever thought would happen to us. We're a very high-achieving family. We're I was saying this kind of ties into the next story. We're an Asian Jewish family, and this was not something that we had a lot of experience with. But but I think it's so true that you go through it together, and you let them know that they have your love no matter what.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we talk about a lot in the book is that nobody's equipped to deal with this problem. Nobody knows what to do with a substance use problem. The substance person with the problem and the family around them. And really, it's about learning skills. And I think family members feeling like I can be empowered. There are things that I can practice. There are things that I can do that will really support my loved one is something that families don't hear enough of. They again, just get told they can't do anything. And that just depowers the whole system. And it's tragic because they can be some of the most influential reasons to make changes.
But what can they do? Because I think I hear in Julia, and Julia, tell me if I'm wrong, a kind of resignation to the limits of what you can do, because you were saying all we can do is offer constant support.
No, that's the sophisticated part of this treatment. It spends a lot of time talking about reinforcement. So what can the family do to reinforce the changes that you want to see and that your loved one needs and wants to make? There's a whole section on limit setting, because you really do have to also set limits. Sometimes you have to let negative consequences actually happen so that the person who needs to change can feel like, oh, you know what, my substance use is resulting in X, Y, and Z, and I don't like that. If you're protecting them or shielding them from negative consequences, you can inadvertently be slowing down the change process. And then sometimes you really do have to set limits and say, you know what, this is unacceptable. I can't live with this. I can't have this conversation. You can't do this in my house. But it takes skill to say and do those things well, too.
Julia, anything you want to say in reaction to that or anything else you want to add?
Oh, I think she's absolutely right that limits are important. And I just wanted to add that this really can happen to anyone. Addiction is a disease. It does not discriminate. Anyone can suffer from this. And I really do believe that absolutely you have to set limits and you have to be firm, but you also have to suspend judgment and disappointment and just really hold out hope.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that because that's a great point. I think there's so much misunderstanding about what a substance use problem is and what it means, and family members in particular, and it's completely understandable. They personalize it. They end up feeling, oh, you're doing this because you don't love me, or oh, you're doing this because you don't care about our marriage or you don't care about the kids. And personalizing the problem or, kind of owning it in that way is a huge burden for the family member, and it's a huge burden for the substance user. And to really figure out how to distance yourself from that piece of it and instead do what you can to manage yourself and your environment is a pretty profound shift for people.
Julia, good luck to you and your family.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for sharing your story. I know it's going to be helpful to others. So here's a tweet that we just got. that kind of challenges even the fact that we're having this conversation. It says, spotlighting drug addiction via talk radio, et cetera, adds to the guilt and depression that a drug addict fights every day. It's not helpful. So is there a point at which talking about it or publishing a book like yours can just feed the guilt and the downward spiral?
I have not heard that. I think actually not talking about it and keeping it in the dark and keeping all of these secrets is what has contributed to the shame. I think there's certain ways people have talked about it that contribute to shame. And, you know, it's a really complicated issue. I mean, it may really feel that way to the person tweeting it out. I don't think it feels that way to most people. And I think most family members, you know, we partnered up with the Partnership for Drugfree.org and coached a bunch of parents to become coaches in this model. And these are parents who've lost children, dealt with significant problems, and they are so excited to be being able to kind of spread this more positive way of thinking about the problem and having families be involved, because families are just heartbroken and frightened all the time. And there's no, I mean, there is reason to feel that way, but there are ways to mitigate it and improve the situation.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, with my guest, Carrie Wilkins, clinical director of the Center for Motivation and Change and co-author of the new book, Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change, as we talk about some of the issues raised by the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, so many other families that don't involve movie stars going through similar things. And this is an opportunity to raise awareness and have some of you call in, and our lines are so full of people who want to talk about relapse, want to talk about high-functioning relatives who are still addicted, how to stop somebody who's on a downward spiral from reaching that point and actually killing themselves, even inadvertently. And Patty in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Patty.
You want to talk about yourself?
I am a recovering alcoholic. I relapsed after about 8 years, and I just wanted to address that. I never thought I was going to drink again, and I really thought I had it. I was going to AA meetings, and I don't know what happened that caused the relapse. And when people say, you know, how could Mr. Hoffman relapse after such a long time, there's so many reasons. I think generally people who are not addicts, who are not alcoholics, don't understand, like, how could you do that? How could you lose all that time? It's something that is sort of inexplicable. And when I look back on my relapse, I can point to certain things that I think affected it, but there's nothing specific. It's sort of, it's mystifying. It's, as they say, cunning and baffling and very scary.
So is there a lesson for you in your own relapse that you could share with people to help prevent it? Was there a trigger? I know you just said it's cunning and baffling, and there wasn't an individual thing. Was there a trigger, something going on in relationships or work or anything like that?
There were a lot of issues going on in my life. There were definitely triggers. What I would want to share is that relapsing was so much worse than getting sober the first time. It was much harder to get sober again. And
why do you think?
I honestly don't know. Maybe your guest can help with that. The after you relapse, it's a strange feeling. You feel just like not trying anymore. It's hard to explain. It's very scary, and this time I had to do a lot of work to get sober again, and I did, and I know from, or at least what I've seen in the papers, Mr. Hoffman was going to AA meetings and was trying to deal with getting back. And that's really hard. And people need to not judge that about people. I've experienced judgment where people say, why? Why can't you be rational about this?
Well, I think that would be the key word. I think in terms of what makes relapse in particular really difficult for people is, again, there's so much misunderstanding about what this problem entails and how complicated it is to get better. I mean, it's a complicated set of behaviors for most people, and it's embedded in their lives in really deep ways, in their relationships and how they spend their time and, you know, it's all over. So to break that habit and create a new life for yourself and then have a significant setback, it's disturbing and it's upsetting. And I think when people around you respond in a judgmental, critical way and say, "Ugh, I can't believe you did that. Look at you. You're back at it again," versus saying, "Wow, what happened? How can I be helpful? What did you underestimate? What needs to happen now to help you get back on track?" Which is a much more helpful way to approach the problem. I think relapses would be less painful because it's just behavior. It's like you got to learn, and you got to learn from the relapse, and you got to understand what happened so that you can kind of prevent it in the future. And it's different things at different times. I mean, it's just complicated.
Patty, thanks for opening up. I know it's going to help other listeners out there. Hang in there.
Thank you.
So there are a lot of people who are sharing an article about relapse right now. I don't know if you've seen this on the web by science writer Seth Mnookin, who wrote in Slate yesterday about his own addiction. And he says, regardless of how much time clean you have, relapsing is always as easy as moving your hand to your mouth. Hmm. So is it helpful to always feel like you're in the shadow of a relapse in order to prevent a relapse?
I would say no, in terms of constantly feeling like I'm in a shadow. It's a pretty dark place to live. We tend to talk about it in really working on your awareness, like keeping your awareness way up in terms of what are the, we call them mooring lines. You know, what are the things that tether me to my sobriety? You know, what's going on in my relationship? How am I spending my time? What are my recovery activities? You know, and really noticing if you start to drift on those things. You know, I haven't gone to a meeting. I used to go to meetings 5 days a week. Now I'm going once a month. What's up with that? I used to go to bed at 10 o'clock at night. Now I'm staying up until 2 o'clock at night. You know, just noticing the drifts in your behavior that are signs that you may be going somewhere risky.
Rich in Richmond, Virginia. Rich, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hi, Brian. So this Philip Seymour Hoffman story hit home. My dad passed away on November 5th from a heroin overdose. And he was an addict from 16 years old and had been clean for almost 20 years prior to this last segment of his usage.
Wow. I'll bet that hit home then.
From Manhattan to Richmond and had seen him in the summer and instantly knew that he was using and did everything in my power to try and prevent him from using. And he did get clean for a couple month period and one relapse and he died. Mm. So this story is trying to take away an upshot here. Yeah, he was a really upstanding guy, really extremely talented watchmaker in Westchester. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. Is the heroin too strong? He was successful. I don't know what happened here. And I don't think he wanted to die.
I'm sure he didn't. There's very few substance users who overdose with intention. In fact, most of them are really struggling and feeling horrible about what they're doing. So I'm sure your dad was really conflicted. And I would say the upshot is that you feel like you did everything that you could do. And I think to feel like I did my best and I used the skills that I had to try to be a positive influence on my loved one who I care deeply about is sometimes all you can do. And I'm really sorry for your loss.
Rich, thanks for sharing.
Thank you, guys.
Before you go, on our comments page, someone writes, "You make it sound so easy to help. Well, it isn't. I feel crappy, but after years of effort, I stopped trying and completely cut off my sister."
Right. And some people really do need to do that. And we talk, I think every single chapter in the book has a mention of this is really hard. It's, you know, in a 30-minute radio show, I'm sure it does sound like I'm saying it's easy. It's really not. This is really tough work. And we spend a third of the book talking about self-care for loved ones who are trying to do this because you just get beat up. It's very difficult to sit with all these complicated feelings and to try to keep your bearings and to try to stay balanced. And it takes a lot of practice to use these skills. So I'm not minimizing that at all.
Are you a harm reduction person? Meaning not necessarily having to stop any substance that you're having a problem with entirely, but managing the harm from it. You know, the whole harm reduction school and the debate around that. Mm-hmm. A number of people are writing in and calling in.
I think that's a whole nother radio show in and of itself. Yes, I'm a big believer in reducing harm. I think I'm a believer in individualized care and really people being able to think about themselves deeply in terms of what has my substance use done to me and my life and what do I need to do? And some people really need to abstain and make that decision. And some people can do it differently. And some people can't change at the rate that we all wish they could. And we need to be treating them as well. I'm not going to exclude them.
And can that even include heroin? Is there a difference between, say, being able to use alcohol a little bit after you've been an addict and manage it, but with heroin it's in a different category?
Yeah, I don't know of any substance use treatment provider who would, with a good conscience, say doing a little heroin is a good idea. So no, I mean, I think, again, it's really helping families and individuals with this problem get the resources they need, get the support they need so they can make educated decisions. And science really has taught us a lot about what is effective. There are effective medications, there are effective treatments available, and we filled the book with that so that family members can help their loved ones find what they need.
Carrie Wilkins, Clinical Director of the Center for Motivation and Change and co-author of Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can keep the conversation going on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or on our Facebook page where people are also talking to each other now at facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our family meeting for our whole program today, Our Noisy Lives. And now from the 311 complaints of noisy New York to a much deeper history of our relationship with noise and sound. David Hendy is here, former BBC reporter and now a professor of media and communications at the University of Sussex. Last year, he produced Noise, A Human History, a 30-part BBC series. Yes, 30-part. That explores what he calls a social history of noise. There's also a companion book of the same name. And David Hendy, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, yes.
And listeners, hello. We're going to talk with David Hendy in a bit about the link between creativity and sound. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that some of you may have seen. So here's the question for you. Do you need silence to work? Or certain kinds of sound or noise? Are you the type who holds up and blocks everything out? Or do you need the din in order to get the creative juices flowing? David Hendy has written a defense of working in noise, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. So start calling now about the link between creativity and noise or silence in your life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm always amazed when some people say they listen to the show while they do creative work. Now, I could see it if you're a visual artist. If you're a writer, I don't think you could listen to a show like this. It would read as noise, I would think. But what kind of noise, what kind of sound do you like to listen to, if any, when you're trying to do creative work, whatever that work is? 212-433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, David Hendy, if we're going to do a little bit of a thumbnail history of the human history and the social history of noise, let's start at the very beginning. Here is early music expert Igor Reznikov singing for you inside the caves at Arcy-sur-Cure in France, where some of the earliest cave paintings have been found. So, David, did sound like that help you better understand our earliest ancestors?
I think so. And, of course, when we're talking about our early ancestors, we're talking about tens of thousands of years ago, we have to admit, in the world of guesswork. But some of it is pretty informed guesswork by archaeologists and musicologists who have explored the passages of caves like those at Arcy-sur-Cure in France. And they've noticed that those parts of the caves which are particularly striking for an acoustic reason, because they have very strong reverberance or echoes, happen to be exactly the same points in the cave where we find art, prehistoric art. And we tend to think of prehistoric art as something which gives us a clue to the deep, distant visual culture. But it's possible to think of these images of animals, they're usually animals, as kind of markers identifying places where perhaps echoes were heard, if there was chanting or some kind of music being performed in these caves. And you can imagine that, you know, when you're in an era which doesn't have a firm grasp on the physical reasons for an echo coming from a cave wall will sound in many respects like a new voice, a new sound coming from behind a veil, in a way, coming from another realm. So there is you can start to imagine the possibility of caves being places where sound was played with and experimented with.
All right, let's jump ahead, 25,000 years, because you write a fair amount about ancient Rome, and it seems like it's the first example of what we can start to think of as modern-sounding noise. And I should say this is a reference to your book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening, which is a companion to the BBC series. So describe what ancient Rome sounded like.
Well, it was pretty noisy, and it was especially noisy at night. I mean, you're talking about a city which, you know, was about 1 million people. I mean, it was the biggest city there had been so far in human history. And it was also a melting pot of a city. This was at the center of an empire, which meant that it was a city that needed feeding and supplying, and the waste products needed to be taken away, and people would come visiting. So there was a constant flow of people in and out. And the elite of Rome were very clear that they didn't want the streets and the routes to be clogged up with deliveries during the day. So there was, for many years, an order that deliveries would only take place at night. I mean, you'd imagine it the other way around. Now, if you were a citizen of Rome and you were living in the thick of the city, you therefore had to put up with deliveries through the night. There would be cattle that would be kind of ushered in and being pushed through the streets of Rome on the way to slaughter. There would be street hawkers, there were gyms. There's some very, very vivid descriptions from writers of the time about the shrieks and the cries of the street hawkers, and the yelps and the slapping of flesh that you could hear coming from gyms. So it was a kind of roiling, bubbling, babbling soundscape.
It's a fascinating description, and compared to modern urban life today, we did some comparisons earlier between the sounds of New York today and the sounds of New York in the 1920s with some archival tape, just as loud but different. And so you're describing ancient Rome. And I wonder if from your research, people always made the distinction between sound and noise in the way we do today, or if that's a more modern construct. And if people in ancient Rome, given what you just described, thought of silence ever as a commodity?
I think that, it's a reasonable constant through history that some sounds have been welcome more than others. There are certain, if you think of noise as a sound that's out of place, that's one useful definition. But another one of noise is it's a sound that someone somewhere doesn't want to hear. And you touched on this earlier, that actually noise is only partly about decibels and loudness. It is about a sound that in some sense irritates. And you can imagine that particularly as people live closer and closer together, jumbled up in cities through the centuries with less and less space, then the issue of other people's sounds becomes more and more of a problem. One of the things that I would say that is quite striking from history is that in many respects, if things work out and you don't have one particular noise that's dominating, and that therefore what you're talking about is just the noise of lots of people living together, but a kind of fairly evenly distributed noise, there is very often a tolerance of that. And what's interesting is that when the rich moved away from sources of noise. And in ancient Rome, they'd say move up to the Palatine Hill, or in 18th century Edinburgh, they'd move to the new town. When they moved away and they didn't mix so much with poorer people, tolerance decreased. In other words, they got so used to quiet that quiet became more of a virtue and noise became something that they regarded as vulgar and unpleasant, a bit like smell.
It sounds very much like the modern world. And we'll take calls in just a second. Our lines are full with people wanting to talk about whether you like to do creative work in silence or in what kind of noise environment, with David Hendy. And it's clear that you want to push back at the general sense that we have that the past was quieter than the present. And I know there's this really cool companion piece to your BBC series in which you asked an electronic musician to retell the entire history of noise in sound, and he does this sort of 14-minute audio tour for you. So we selected at random 3 points in the piece. Here is, from the beginning, prehistoric times. And his representation from the middle, probably around the 1500s. And from the end, say the post-industrial revolution period. The archaic sounds of typewriters. So what did those three taken together represent, very briefly?
Well, that was very much a mix put together by a musician, very much his own interpretation. But it seems to me that what you're dealing with here is a kind of, there's an eternal struggle as well as a benign relationship between humanity and natural sound. And I think one of the things that I think we were trying to convey in the series, that if you think of the noise of machinery, most of us can agree that a lot of that is unpleasant and intrusive, and we'd like to minimize it. But there is also a lot of sounds in history that come from human beings, fellow human beings, that have in the past been thought of as noise because they've been exotic or unusual or alien and mystifying. And so one of the things that we were trying to do, both in that kind of musical composition and in the series as a whole, was to explore the idea of trying to get behind something, a noise that seems alien and mystifying, to understand it from within. And therefore, in the process, it starts to cease to be noise. And you can think about this in terms of, you know, musical taste. You know, what we like is music, what other people like is noisy. And yet, if you can transcend that instinct, if you can start to learn about a music, you tend to appreciate it more. I mean, you know, fans of classical music say this: if you can learn about it, you can appreciate it. And I think that applies to sounds both natural and human, even if we can't quite bring ourselves to kind of really appreciate modern machine noise.
Jessica in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica. How do you like to do your creative work, and what kind of sound environment?
Hi, Brian. I'm a theater director, so I like noise that presses in, noise that can make the world feel a little bit smaller and lets my mind be a little bit more expansive. I'm working on a project now that involves sound in the city, and as part of that project, I sent out a questionnaire to friends and theater artists about how they work and what kinds of sound, how they feel about sound in the world. And it was fascinating. The groups divided pretty evenly into people who love noise, and to not have it, it makes them anxious. And then there are the people who just, it's too much, and they need something with a little bit more rhythm to it. And if they feel jarred at all, they can't focus. So our focus has been with this production, with State of Play Productions, in terms of finding out how sound fits into the muchness of the world and how much we pay attention to it.
Beautiful. Thank you. Justin in Fort Greene. You're on WNYC. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
All right.
Good. So I just wanted to call in and say that I appreciate a lot of the noises in the city. I live downstairs from somebody who's a film editor. And, you know, I hear a lot of sub bass coming down from upstairs sometimes. I also live not too far away from Fort Greene Park, and there are concerts during the summer. But I moved to the city because it's a creative place, and I wanted to be creative, and I'm happy that there are people that are here that are doing their thing, and if it's a little bit noisy sometimes, I think that's okay. I expected that when I moved here, and I think other people should expect that when they move here as well.
Justin, thank you so much. Dimitri in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, hello. I just wanted to say, whenever I do any sort of intellectual exercise, which is mostly reading for me, I love listening to music, but it either has to be really bad pop that doesn't make any sort of impression on me.
Huh.
It's just a rhythmic noise in the background, or any sort of chill-out electronic music with minimal lyrics. But on a few occasions, I've tried to read a difficult text while listening to one of my jazz or classical records, and it's a complete disaster.
So
it just doesn't work.
In other words, nothing good.
Any sort of good music vies for my attention.
That's great. Does that ring a bell with you, David Hendy, when you think about your own creative work? If you're listening to music, is it better if it's bad music because you don't get drawn into the content?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, two of your callers now have used almost exactly the same word, which is rhythm. The music has to be rhythmic in some way. And this is, I mean, this goes back to the invention of background music, piped music. You know, back in the 1920s when the French composer Eric Satie was in a restaurant trying to have a meal with his friend Fernand Léger, the painter, and was getting really irritated by the sound of the band. It was too intrusive. And he left that meal planning the idea of what he called furniture music, and he basically used fragments of popular melodies but remixed and repeated over and over again. And that's what works, that kind of rhythmic music, because of course our hearing brain is constantly on the alert for something unusual and different. So when it kind of notices that, well, nothing unusual and different, it's kind of recurring pattern here, it can kind of switch off, that cocktail party effect of kind of acknowledging that it's there but pushing it in the background takes over. And when something is kind of striking, then that's when the problem starts.
Daisy in Nassau County, you're a writer, Daisy?
Yes, I write short stories, and I'm also a law student. When I am writing, I need a calamity of activity. So I have the TV on something that I'm going to ignore. I typically have something on the stove. I'm cooking. I'm also doing laundry. So I have the hum of the washing machine in the background. I have the boiling and the simmering of the stove. And something that I can hear, that I can be drawn to, but then I can also tune out as I'm writing. When I'm doing work related to my law school, I usually just have the television on, anything. And gradually as I'm getting into the text, I'll put the volume lower and lower so that I can sort of refocus. But I take breaks based on what I hear coming from the television. I do that all the time.
That is quite a cacophony. But if you're a writer, how do you write with talking in the background on television, presuming there's talking?
Right. It helps me. A lot of times, if I get swept up in the story, I'll also be caught up in other thoughts. So another thought will creep into my mind, and that will take away from the story. Whereas if I have the TV going on, I can refocus on that sound that's going on in the background without being drawn into it, and then I can go back to my story. It also helps me with taking breaks. I can be seated for hours at a time and forget that the world is even there. But I have a moment to then get up, check the stove, get up, check the washing machine, and then I can go back to what
wild.
I was doing.
That's wild. And you said you're in law school. How are you going to deal with the silence of the courtroom?
Oh, it's deadening so far. I've had that experience. I focus on different sounds. So I'll focus on the echoes in the halls. I'll focus on the calamity from the DAs, from behind the doors. So I focus on many different things, paper shuffling, pens scribbling on legal pads. I focus on a lot of different sounds when I'm in that environment. But I do notice that it is deadening.
Amazing. Daisy, thank you for your call. And we're just about out of time, but David Hendy, thinking about your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where you wanted to push back against Thoreau, who went out to Walden Pond so he could work in silence, or Jonathan Franzen, who you referred to, who likes to turn on a pink noise machine so that he could write without the usual world sounds intruding, and you wanted to push back on that. And boy, it looks like you're in friendly company among our listeners.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say in a way I was quite sympathetic to Thoreau, because I think that one of the things I was trying to explore was the idea that, in fact, he didn't actually go in search of silence. He went in order for all the other sounds which might otherwise be ignored or overheard or missed, for them to bloom. So he could actually enjoy the sound of the pitch pines rubbing and creaking against the shingles and the cry of the birds. So it really isn't about silence. The thing is that it's about creating the space for a whole load of other noises, if you like, other sounds that we otherwise miss, to kind of have their day in the sun.
And before you go, in our last 15 seconds, as a historian of the world through sound, is there one particular moment in history you would most want to be able to listen to?
Well, I suppose I would love to be able to go back to the very, very deep, distant past. I would love to know actually what happened in these echoey caves. Are we right in imagining that this was somewhere where we can perhaps detect the origin of both music and religion through sound?
David Hendy, who did a social history of sound for the BBC, a 30-part series, and has a companion book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next on our family meeting, Our Noisy Lives. What happens when our lives stop being noisy because we can't hear that well? We're actually going to talk about hearing loss, including a story from several people I know with hearing loss who say they're surprised at how loud it is. Stay with us.